Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of this court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Lauren Shore, and along with my co-counsel, Major Grover Baxley, we represent Staff Sergeant Wilbur J. McIntosh, Jr. Trial defense counsel was in possession of two sexual assault nurse examinations conducted on the complaining witness, which bookend the time frame of the allegations. The first exam was conducted just hours after an alleged assault. The second exam was conducted after years of alleged abuse. These reports showed no evidence of sexual activity. Both reports showed an intact hymen with no injury, no abnormalities, no scarring, and no bruising. These reports were never given to the jury. Focusing on the test as laid out by this court in United States v. Polk, we turn first to whether or not the allegations are true. There's no dispute over that in this case. The evidence simply was not given to the jury. Turning next to whether there's a reasonable explanation. And now in their affidavits explaining their decision not to introduce the same reports, both trial defense counsel offer a number of different reasons why they made the decision they did, none of which are reasonable in light of
the facts. Do you have the affidavits in front of you?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're looking at page 2 of Benjamin Clark's and then page something. The first page of Mr. McCormick's?
Yes, Your Honor.
Rolling over. So are you going to go through those critical paragraphs and tell us why those are not sound tactical reasons?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. Yes.
And please use the actual language of the affidavits rather than just argumentation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. 100%. As you can see in both of the affidavits, they indicate that their decision, repeatedly, frankly, indicate their decision was tactical and strategic. However, just because they call it tactical doesn't make it tactical when there's nothing on the record to back that up. As the Fifth Circuit recognized in Moore v. Johnson, which was cited in the government's brief, a court should not be required to condone unreasonable decisions parading under the umbrella of strategy or to fabricate tactical decisions on behalf of counsel when it appears on the face of the record that no strategic decision was made.
Do you have any scientific evidence whatsoever that their strategic decision was not backed up by scientific evidence, that indeed most instances of molestation can nonetheless result with normal finding?
Your Honor, we don't have any additional affidavits or evidence that specifically say what a sane would have said in this case. However,
well, in the absence of scientific evidence that these reports show something other than what the defense counsel suggested, why would we think that was unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, because although the report said this doesn't exclude the possibility of sexual assault, they do show no injury. What Mr. GM
and then my question, which is if there is no injury in many, many instances where there either was or was not sexual activity, why would that not be a reasonable decision?
Well, Your Honor, because all they did was talk to their own sane, and their sane just confirmed what was in the reports. They never went and talked to the sanes who conducted the examinations where they could have found, is this what you would expect to find?
I'm asking you hypothetically, do you have any scientific evidence that shows that that's not what they could have found?
No, Your Honor, because the investigation was never conducted by trial defense counsel. So we have nothing to say what else could have been presented to the jury.
Is it the defense's position that these affidavits are basically preposterous on their face? That's what you seem to be saying.
Our position, Your Honor, is that they conducted no investigation into what could have been presented to the jury. And in the 11th hour,
The affidavit seems to say something else. The affidavit seems to say that they thought a lot about this and they had a significant tactical reason for not doing it. Are you questioning the truth of the affidavit, or are you just saying it's absurd on its face?
And not questioning the truth of the affidavit, Your Honor. Our position is that because of what's contained in the reports and what their purported theory was, these same reports don't contradict that theory in any way. If you look to the closing argument, Mr. GM repeatedly states over six times, where's the trauma, where's the evidence, where's the medical evidence? And he could have made that exact same argument with these reports entered in, except then it would have been bolstered by evidence to say there is no evidence of trauma. There is no evidence of sexual activity, none whatsoever. And so to say that it was strategy.
I'd like to turn your attention to Mr. McCormick's affidavit, second page, appears Joint Appendix 359.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where it says, the appellant advised me that he fully understood this issue and my recommendation not to present this evidence, and he concurred fully with this tactical decision.
Understood.
Why isn't that dispositive of this issue?
Your Honor, specifically, if you look to United States v. Davis, which is at 60 MJ 469 cited in the briefs, in that particular case, the appellant also concurred with that strategy, but his advice from counsel was based on flawed advice. What we have when you look to both Mr. McCormick and Captain Clark's affidavit is they appear to think that they were required to disprove the sexual assault rather than just present something that created a reasonable doubt in the member's mind. This evidence undoubtedly could have presented or offered a reasonable doubt to the members. And so he was not required to completely exclude the possibility of sexual activity or otherwise.
Why wouldn't this lead us to a result where counsel can fully inform an accused? The accused can make an informed decision, tactical decision, but then come to this court or the CCAs and say, boy, this didn't work out too well for me. I want another shot at this.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's not what the appellant is seeking in this case. In this case, even if an appellant does not concede that he concurred with the decision.
But you said just a few minutes ago in oral argument that you didn't quibble with the accuracy of the affidavits.
The affidavits are in contradiction, Your Honor, 100%. On that point, appellant never concedes in his affidavit that he actually concurred with this decision. That is only contained within Mr. McCormick's affidavit. However, even if he did concede, even if he did concur with the decision, if it's based on a lack of information or a lack of advice, it's not a fully informed decision on the part of the appellant. And that duty falls to the attorney to completely investigate that line of reasoning.
And what in the record makes you think he wasn't fully informed?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. McCormick states that he talked to his own SANE expert. But what wasn't in the affidavit was whether he talked to the SANEs who conducted these examinations, whether he subpoenaed them, whether they were there ready to testify, whether they even had an opportunity to talk to him about what their findings were, hypothetically what they would expect to find in these situations. Any of that information.
Well, counsel, he says in his affidavit that based on handling many of these cases, he didn't think that it was unusual and that it was probative of nothing. And so I go back to my initial question, which is I could understand if you came in here and said there's five studies out there that say that he was wrong, that it was probative, and therefore he should have done X, Y, and Z. But A, you've suggested that we've not noted any such studies, and B, I'm aware that there are studies that say the exact opposite.
Absolutely understood, Your Honor. It is the fact that he didn't investigate any of those possibilities. He simply used
that he already knew from his experience. I mean, he has to reinvestigate every single time?
No, Your Honor. Further investigation would have been prudent in this case. But what is most probative in this situation is that he had the very evidence that would support his argument. And then, once you add to that, not only were these reports potentially extremely relevant, not potentially, they were extremely powerful evidence, but then you have trial counsel's argument and Mr. McCormick's failure to object. Trial counsel, in her rebuttal findings argument, says when the report, the sexual examination report, went forward to law enforcement, this case continued. This wasn't a case where medical evidence didn't exist or DNA didn't exist in order for substantiation of this little girl's version of horrific events. This is a case where all of that existed, and that's why we're here. Mr. McCormick has said repeatedly that his theory was to point out that there was no medical evidence, nothing out there to substantiate this. Then trial counsel alludes to the fact that this evidence does exist, and Mr. McCormick doesn't do anything. He doesn't object.
Counsel, the first report says, quote, the lack of abnormal findings does not rule out the occurrence of sexual assault. The second one says the same thing. You're saying that not putting that in is IAC?
Your Honor, not giving that to the members to consider, especially when trial counsel said it did corroborate her version of events. That is a misstatement of what those reports said. And then the members asked for reports contained within law enforcement records. The members were clearly looking for this information or at least clarification on these reports, and Mr. McCormick did nothing.
But is that ineffective assistance of counsel based on the issue before us, or is it ineffective assistance of counsel on something that's not before us in terms of the failure to take appropriate action?
It's the appellant's position, Your Honor, that the failure to object and give the reports to the members is, well, the failure to object is part and parcel of the IAC for not giving the reports initially. When we are, when the court evaluates ineffective assistance of counsel, you have to it has to be evaluated based on what counsel knew at the time. At the time, before all argument, and then after trial counsel's rebuttal argument, the trial defense counsel knew the members were left with this impression that the reports corroborated the complaining witness's version of events. He had an ace card. To contradict that 100%, never presented it to the members, never objected, which is his failure to object simply shows that he had no tactical strategy here. That is his theory the entire time.
Well, wasn't it better to leave the members with the impression that there was no medical evidence rather than have a bunch of sane nurses get up and explain why, in many cases, there is no medical evidence?
Potentially, Your Honor, but...
Isn't that a tact? Potentially, so that's a tactical reason. It just didn't work out.
The appellant's position is, in this case, there was not enough that Mr. McCormick knew at the time to be able to make that call and make it reasonably under the circumstances. Moreover, he stood up there and was saying, there is no medical evidence. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? Had he entered the evidence, he would have been able to then say, the government hid this evidence from you. The government kept it from you, and now I had to be the one to present it. He would at least have the opportunity to argue, now there is this it's evidence of absence of evidence, essentially. Rather than just asking where it is, he can say, you have something that says there was no injury, no abnormalities, intact hymen, all of the things that are contained within that report, and he could make his argument even stronger. He essentially limits himself in his argument by not putting these reports in and at least allowing the members to consider it. The members are reasonable people, and the only exclusion or testimony they would have had, according to the affidavits, is that, well, this can't be excluded as a possibility. But you have an individual being examined hours after an alleged assault by a grown man, and there's no evidence. The reasonable person would find that to be extremely probative, extremely relevant, not to mention when you add in the weakness of the evidence overall. In Strickland, the court says that a verdict or conclusion that is only weakly supported by the record is more likely to have been affected by errors than one with an overwhelming record of support. We simply don't have an overwhelming record of support in this case. Evaluating BH's testimony, it's consistent at some points, but fairly vague. On certain areas, she says she could have been dreaming. She doesn't remember. All the events run through her head. Based on the findings alone, objectively, it appears the members had questions as to her credibility. Then you have the testimony of her friend, VJ, which doesn't actually appear to go to any charge of which appellant was found guilty. And even if you believe her testimony, or even if her testimony is considered, it's completely inconsistent with BH's. They tell two completely opposite stories. Finally, the DNA evidence. Again, the DNA evidence doesn't go to an event that he was found guilty of. It goes to an event that is outside the charge time frame. Moreover, the DNA was only on the complaining witness's underwear. It is, in fact, evidence that the appellant never touched her. It was nowhere on her body, externally or internally, hours after this alleged assault. And then finally, you have her mother's testimony, and her mother's testimony, the credibility simply isn't there based on her bias and motive. And her testimony, again, is frankly incredible and unbelievable. She claims that he opened the door with his underwear down. The government did not have a strong case in this trial. The evidence was not overwhelming. It was weak. And Mr. McCormick's failure to present these reports that were 100% aligned with his theory was a complete ineffectiveness on his part. Then you add in trial counsel's argument, and the members are left with a false impression as to what the evidence says. That is why Mr. McCormick's decision was unreasonable, and the prejudice is absolute, because you have a weak case backed with a failure to present evidence that was 100% consistent with defense's theory. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Thomas Alford, and along with Major Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in this case. It is appellant's heavy burden to show that his trial defense counsel's decision not to admit the two SANE reports was an error so serious that his counsel were not functioning as counsel within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment. He has not done so. Nor has appellant met his burden of showing there is a reasonable probability the result in this case would have been different absent the alleged deficiency. Appellant essentially argues that there was only one way to litigate this case. He offers no limiting principle on the requirement to admit these reports and asserts a per se rule demanding introduction of SANE reports when they show no injury. To adopt a position like this would interfere with the constitutionally protected independence of counsel and restrict the wide latitude counsel must have in making tactical decisions. As this court well knows, the first prong in the analysis, although this court can look at either whether it's a deficiency or whether there was prejudice, but typically if you first look at whether there was a deficiency, that's governed by Strickland. And even if this court uses either Polk or Strickland, under both of those cases, the deficiency is looked at under an objective standard of reasonableness. And Polk adds that almost an additional element or an additional step in the analysis. Did the deficiency fall measurably below the conduct ordinarily expected of fallible lawyers? Using both of those standards, any of those standards, the trial defense counsel's actions in this case were 100% completely reasonable. As this court knows also, that it must start off with a strong presumption that counsel's conduct falls within a wide range of professional assistance. And as the Supreme Court said in 2011 in Harrington against Richter, even under a de novo review, the standard for judging counsel's representation is a most deferential one. And this court also knows that when looking at trial defense counsel's actions, you look ex ante, not ex post. So you don't look with the benefit of hindsight, but you look at what the counsel was thinking at the time of trial, before trial, not after the fact, when perhaps more information is revealed. Now, looking at this case, the civilian defense counsel's strategy was simply a failure of proof. And it's not in the joint appendix, but starting out in voir dire, on page 223 of the record, the defense counsel plants these seeds and essentially says that, do you all understand that it is the government's burden to prove this case? He discussed some other things. The trial counsel discussed the CSI effect, but he also he made it clear from the beginning that this was going to be his theme and theory of the case was that it was a failure of proof. Now, turning to the actual affidavits themselves, both trial defense counsel made reasonable, indeed wise, assessments that the best course of action was to leave the SANE reports out of evidence and then argue their absence to the members. And you may say to yourself, well, why is it that that's a reasonable strategy? Because couldn't he just argue the same thing if he had put in both of those reports? Well, the answer to that is no, because had the defense put on the two SANE nurses, at that point they're subject to cross-examination. And those SANE experts, according with their own reports, are going to have to acknowledge that the lack of injury is not probative of anything. So what happens? Well, if you look at Captain BC's affidavit, he recognizes that if that were to happen, you would not just have one defense witness, you would have two defense witnesses who acknowledge that the forensic science says, or the two reports say, that you can't conclude one way or the other what it means. So then the defense counsel would have to not just argue, where's the medical evidence, government? He would also have to rebut that theory that would be presented, no doubt, on cross-examination. I also want to point out that these SANE reports were not unambiguous evidence of innocence. The defense expert stated that, and this is all that's in the record, and it's in addition to the SANE reports, that the SANE reports The absence of any kind of injury to the victim's genitalia does not rule out sexual assault. That's on the page 358 of the joint appendix. They also discussed this tactic with appellant, as Judge Olson pointed out, on page 359 of the joint appendix. And as the Supreme Court also recognized in Harrington, they said that in that particular case, there was the possibility that expert testimony could shift attention to esoteric matters of forensic science, distract the jury from whether a victim in that case was telling the truth, or transform the case into a battle of the experts.
Well, which way does that cut? Isn't obfuscation the stock in trade of defense counsel? Let's pitch it over into murky questions of forensic science and let the members puzzle it out.
That might be a good strategy in one case, Judge Stuckey, but that doesn't mean that the strategy taken by defense counsel in this particular case was objectively unreasonable, especially in light of other factors, which, as I pointed out in our brief, he also contested the chain of custody, not just with the DNA expert, but also with the victim, BH, herself. And I'd also like to point out, although it wasn't mentioned in the brief, the SANE reports themselves, if you look at the joint appendix on page 336, on page 332, this is the 2007 SANE report. There's a narrative portion in there where it discusses what the actual report was. Now, that could be used potentially by the prosecutor in rebuttal as a rehabilitation with a prior consistent statement. So not only do you have these SANE reports that say that they're not probative of anything, it actually says it in both reports, but you have a possible prior consistent statement. It's also in the second SANE report on joint appendix page 343. It discusses the circumstances surrounding the report. And also in that second report, BH discusses that she was in pain, which is another reason why defense counsel may not want to put those reports into evidence and why it was objectively reasonable. And also there's another important factor I don't think that was discussed by either side, and that's that when these SANE reports come in and the SANE nurses testify, the members then know how intrusive these reports are. And that could spill over into sentencing, assuming that appellant is found guilty, is, oh my gosh, she had to go through this not one time but two times and describe in detail exactly what a SANE exam entails, which is extremely, extremely intrusive. Another point I highlighted in my brief, but I just want to foot stomp it here before you, is that the appellant was acquitted of sodomy, forcible sodomy, and sodomy with a child, which carries with it life imprisonment. So not only was trial defense counsel constitutionally effective, he was successful in his strategy, because if you look at the sodomy with the child charge, that dates back to 2006. And the SANE report it spans 2006 to 2008. The SANE report was from 2007. So that SANE report from 2007 didn't relate to the actual charges he was convicted of, because the rapes were charged from 2009 to 2010. That could only draw the conclusion it related to the sodomy, which he was acquitted of. So you don't have just, you have the prior consistent statements, you have the possibility that the SANE nurses would get into the excruciating details of the reports, the chain of custody, the fact that he was acquitted. Looking at all of these things together, the totality of the circumstances, there was no ineffectiveness. Even if this court does find that and switches to prejudice, I just want to quickly hit the prejudice standard that has slightly changed since Strickland, I would argue, from Harrington. And if I could quote Justice Kennedy from Harrington, he says, "Strickland asks whether it is reasonably likely the result would have been different. This does not require a showing that counsel's actions more likely than not altered the outcome, but the difference between Strickland's prejudice standard and a more probable than not standard is slight and matters only in the rarest case. The likelihood of a different result must be substantial, not just conceivable." So even if you do find that the trial defense counsel erred by not putting these reports in, and when you look at the prejudice prong, the appellant has to show, his burden is to show that close to 50%, that would have had an impact on the findings. In the light of the fact that you have at least three eyewitnesses who independently observed the conduct that occurred, the fact that you have DNA evidence that was located on BH's underwear, all that other evidence indicates that there was no prejudice in this case. And also, importantly, trial defense counsel was still able to cross-examine BH, and he was able to impeach that DNA testimony, and he was able still to contest the fact that the DNA was not found in or around her vagina. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Trial defense counsel were not constitutionally defective. Their decision not to admit the SANE reports was reasonable and indeed wise. Additionally, appellant has wholly failed to demonstrate that admission of the SANE reports would have substantially undermined the DNA evidence or the testimony of the eyewitnesses. There is thus no reasonable probability that the panel in this case would arrive at a different outcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant has the opportunity for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government bears the burden of proof. If these exams had been admitted, the government would have been left to argue that it's possible that such prolonged violent trauma, or in the case of the first examination, such acute trauma, might not cause an injury. That would have been a different view of the evidence from the member's perspective. Specifically, the members are then looking at something that says we cannot exclude the possibility of trauma. That's simply all it says. We can't exclude it. The government argues that it wasn't probative of anything. That's not what the reports say. The reports say that sexual assault cannot be excluded, but there is simply no evidence of any sexual activity.
Okay, counsel, I'm back with the old Harvard Law School sword that cuts both ways. Which way does that cut?
Your Honor, frankly, it cuts to the appellant, because when you have no evidence of sexual assault, none whatsoever, after years of violent trauma, abuse of an 8 to 10-year-old child, you are faced with a question of how is this possible that there is no evidence of even sexual activity? That is where...
Because you have three sane nurses saying so.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, as this court knows, and as the government pointed out, we can't Monday morning quarterback this. We can't use the benefit of hindsight. The government is standing here saying, well, this could have happened, and this could have been argued, and this could have been argued. That was not trial defense counsel's strategy. That was not contained within their affidavit. Trial counsel simply stated that based on his experience, he didn't think that this, leaving it with the possibility that it could not be excluded, was enough. With regard to whether or not trial defense counsel was successful in his strategy, this can be distinguished from the other cases where successful strategy saves the ineffective claim. Because in this case, he was only acquitted of 2 of the 6 charges. And for instance, Green, this court found that in a case where you're successful and the evidence is not overwhelming, then no, maybe that's not ineffective. That's not what we have here. We have a case where the evidence was simply not overwhelming whatsoever, and trial defense counsel failed to put in extremely powerful evidence. It was a stretch for the members to convict based on this evidence alone. In the absence of these reports, this court can simply not be confident in the appellant's verdict of guilty. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks both counsel. Case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you very much.